Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode 142, I was very privileged to have Daniel K. Hatton. He is a VR creator, filmmaker, and you could say digital nomad as well for a short period of time. We talked about many different things. We talked about how he got started in the sort of freelance film industry. We talked about how he ended up after a 30-hour journey out to Malaysia, which eventually led him to Indonesia to one of his biggest projects he ever did. And yeah, we were just basically talking about the sort of getting started in the sort of industry. Got to say, very interesting chap, delight to speak to, and I look forward to speaking to him again in the near future. But yeah, please sit back, enjoy the show. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't, and yeah, if you could drop a like or a comment, that would be appreciated it too. Have a good day and enjoy the show. Peace. Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors. Blimey. Yes, this is the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is episode 142. And on this episode, I am very privileged to have Daniel K. Hatton. I don't think he's any relation to a certain boxer up in Manchester, but you never know. We'll find out a little bit more about him. He is a VR creator, filmmaker, and yeah, a freelance filmmaker for the last 7 years. How are you today, Dan? Daniel?
I'm good. As we were just saying, the weather's nice. So that always boosts your mood, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Look, but
especially when you live in the UK.
Yeah. No, tell me about it. Like, you're a Londoner as well, aren't you?
Yeah, just outside of London.
Put it this way. I've got to say, we have been quite fortunate over the last few weeks. It hasn't really rained at all, but which is kind of like, okay, April showers, not here. Fingers crossed. Well, you know, it's a bank holiday weekend this weekend. So
it's a given that it's going to rain. You can always rely on it.
No doubt. I have to ask this question.
Look, go for it.
You have been, an independent filmmaker, like freelance for the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see yourself being this when you were assistant manager at Blockbusters open up years ago?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was really thinking about what I was going to be doing in the future when I was there. Yeah. I was just kind of enjoying the ride at the time. And also because I was am such a film geek, working in somewhere like Blockbuster was just amazing because you got your free rentals every week. So I don't think I slept during that time. I'd work most evenings, go home, just watch a load of films, and then just go back in again the following day. So no, it definitely wasn't something that that was on my radar. But then I left. Something happened. I can't remember something happened. So I left. That sounds really ominous. I think like something happened in the store I was working in. There was a bit of a shakeup, and then I left. And then applied for a load of jobs in that sort of industry in London, and then got a job with a company who at the time was Nielsen EDI. And I'm still not entirely sure how I got that job. Apparently, I was second in line to get that job, but the person that they wanted said no. so then I got it. So I'm glad they said no. But basically they were an American company that tracked how much money films made at the cinemas and stuff for the distributors. Yeah. So I managed to wangle that somehow. I was there for about 7 years, which was pretty cool. And then, you know, we used to get invited to, well, every now and then we used to get invited to like premieres and after parties and things like that, which is quite cool. But then it's the premieres and stuff like that were kind of these, when you look at it from the outside, they're these really like spectacular star-studded events.
Yeah.
When you go, unless you're one of those stars, not so much. You know, it's you'll walk the red carpet, but you'll have people come over and obviously see that you're not famous or something, and they'll be like, can you move on, please? the stars are coming in. Exactly. Can you get in? Riff-raff here.
Put in the small pen you, in the corner.
Yeah. And then you get ushered inside, and then you have to sit there for like ages while you're waiting for all the stars. And a lot of the times they're not sort of big stars. They're like generally the Z-list celebrities. And you have to wait for all of them to get in and sit down before they put the film on. And you watch it on the screen as well as you sit there. So you're just sitting there thinking like, these people need to hurry up. I don't even know who this person is, but they need to hurry up because, you know, I want to catch the last train and I'm not going to at this rate. So they were kind of crazy experiences, but that was really good. So I did that for about 7 years. And then I think for about the final year I was there, I started doing some bits and pieces with a friend for an entertainment website. Mm-hmm. And basically he had set it all up himself. He'd just reached out to the editor of this website and said, look, you know, notice you haven't got much content on your YouTube channel. Would you be interested in like me and my friends just producing some stuff for you? So she was like, yep, sounds good. One thing I will ask is that you don't interview Russell Brand. And that was it. Other than that, we had a carte blanche to do whatever we wanted to do. But for some reason, just didn't want us to. Because Russell Brand was so accessible for some reason. So we're like, yep, fine. Funnily enough, he wasn't on our shortlist. So we just started making content for that. And then it sort of varied from like video essays about, you know, certain movies and stuff. And then we did interviews with like actors and people in the industry that we were fans of, not necessarily like big people. I think the biggest person we interviewed was probably Benga Akinabe from The Wire. And that was really cool. And at that point I hadn't actually seen The Wire. So I was quite cool, but my friend was a massive Wire fan, so he was kind of freaking out. So we did a lot of that, and then it was cool because it was very relaxed, and we'd rent out like this little function room above this pub just around the corner from Leicester Square, and I would just go on my lunchtime. I'd get in early and then I'd be like, right, I'm going to take a 2-hour lunch because I'm going to run and shoot this thing. And we just kept doing that, and then we'd cover like film festivals and stuff, and interview people on the red carpets there. And then this other YouTube channel saw our stuff, and they had a big subscriber base at the time. I think they had over 100,000 subscribers at the time. They're even bigger now. But they reached out and they were like, oh yeah, we really like your stuff. Do you want to come and do some work for us? And that was like the first time I thought, oh, maybe I'm actually all right at this. Because it never really occurred to me before. I just thought, oh, this is fun. I like doing this. But yeah, they got in touch, and that's kind of put us in front of even bigger celebrities. So, you know, I got to shoot an interview with Daniel Radcliffe, who is surprisingly small.
Yeah, no, like he's a teeny, teeny man.
He is so small. It's weird. You don't expect it. And I'll never forget it as well. He just got out of the car at the end of the red carpet, and you can literally hear the collective people around you going, oh my God, he's really small.
Oh,
and everyone like just out loud. And there's no way he didn't hear that, because there's like about 50 odd people all commenting about how small he is.
You know what? So, I would really like, with Daniel Radcliffe, you might get comments about him being really small, but I would really like to just see like his sort of wild child period in his life. Basically, when he just woke up one morning, just like stared back at a bed with just countless half naked people on it, got no walk. And then basically sitting there with a wand in hand, and
That's the reality show I never knew I needed. Until now.
Yeah.
That would have been amazing. The Harry Potter years. That'd be amazing. So started doing bits and pieces for them. And then that's when I thought, maybe I could actually charge money for doing stuff like this. So then I started advertising online and putting quotes in for projects that were being advertised. Did a few, and then kind of got to a point where I quite enjoy doing this rather than sitting in an office 9 to 5 doing the same thing day in, day out. As much as I enjoyed a job, and it was a very relaxed atmosphere, and it was always daily we'd always have a good laugh, and it almost didn't feel like work. But I think after 7 years of doing the same thing day in, day out, I kind of enjoyed doing something where every job was different. In the end, it started affecting the work a little bit, because my mind wasn't on the job. So I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna jump in and just try and do this thing full time. And then started the usual doing weddings here and there. Mm-hmm. Which I very quickly realized I hated. It's funny when you just line of work, I think it's weddings really that make you realize how much of a control freak you are, because I didn't like that I wasn't in control of how things were going. So sometimes you'll have a technical issue and stuff like that. At a wedding, if you've got a technical issue, that's it, you're screwed. There's no redoing it. And that's what I hated. So I'd spend the entire day just on edge. Because and the thing is, I would have multiple setups as well. As I went on, I would just get other smaller cameras, just anything, just so I had a backup option. So I'd usually have about 3 cameras running in different angles and stuff. Yeah. And it was more, it wasn't so much that I was planning on using them, but it was just that if anything that had happened, then I had that backup option. That also kept me slightly sane, I think. Because I had one wedding where the registrar stood in front of one of my cameras for the entire ceremony. And that's another thing. Registrars and vicars and all that, they hate you. They absolutely despise you. And they don't make it easy for you at all.
I can imagine. How many years ago was this when you were doing the wedding stuff for the beginning?
That was probably about 6 or 7 years ago. But that was essentially just to get money in.
Yeah,
because I was just jumping in at a deep end. I didn't really know anything about marketing myself. Some may say I still don't. it was just because they were coming up, and you do one, and then it's word of mouth, isn't it? With that sort of thing. So next thing you're booking all of their friends' weddings, and then it was weird because. I mean, I hated doing them. They were essentially a job. They were just nothing but stressful. But then I did somehow find myself shortlisted for a wedding videographer award for some reason. And I never even rated my stuff. It was all very basic. I didn't do any of the fancy stuff that everyone else does. it was all very sort of like documentary style. I liked to shoot them as if like they didn't know I was there. Which at one wedding, the bride didn't know I was there. And apparently she complained to her husband that I didn't turn up. It's like, I've been here longer than you. Wait,
did you see that shrubbery next to us?
Yeah, yeah.
That was him.
That was me. I was incognito.
Yeah. The reason why I asked how many years ago was it, it's because simply when like people go, yeah, technology, and like they go, oh, cameras with two card slots and stuff like this. And when you sort of, with cameras especially, it's weird because you get a particular model of camera and it won't change for about 4 or 5 years, then it changes. Well, not unless if it's a Sony, which seems like every 60 days. But that's another story. But the sort of jumps which come along every sort of 2-3 years just across the models, it's like especially if you're, well, you should be filming digital these days, but even back then when it was a sort of very cusp, it's a case of, yeah, single card slots, double card slots, then all of a sudden it's like, yes, I need that in my life. And just because you have a card slot, and people don't realize card slots, like the little memory cards you get in that, they'll run from now to, like, from here to doomsday. Not a problem until you have that one event, which is a once in a lifetime thing, like a wedding or anything like this, which you can't get people back to do it all over again. And then it will fail. You can't just be like, hey, sorry.
and that's the thing. And it's like, how do you, I don't know, like when you stipulate in the contracts where, you know, you can't be held accountable for certain things, like, you know, an act of God or whatever, you can't stipulate, you know, something like that, because that's, you know, down to you, even though you have nothing to do with it. Sometimes there is technical failures and stuff like that, and it's unavoidable, unfortunately, but you can't stipulate that in a contract. But funnily enough, like, I must admit, I've never had a major problem doing any like equipment wise. The only problems that I came across in doing weddings was people. like the registrar standing in front of it. I had another one where the itinerary for the day wasn't on schedule.
Okay.
And I spoke to, I think it was the Toastmaster, and I said, like, oh, you know, can you give me a rough time when you're going to do the cake and the first dance? Because I've got this itinerary, but it hasn't gone to schedule so far. And he was like, oh, well, we changed the itinerary yesterday. I was like, all right. I was like, well, I didn't know about it. And he said, we changed it for you. I'm like, well, why are you why is it, that doesn't even make sense. Why are you changing things for me to benefit me? I'll work around you. That doesn't even make any sense. But anyway, so he said, oh, we're going to do the cake and the first dance about 6:30. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay. And also, I was just going to point out, usually, no one ever usually stipulates this in their contracts about getting fed at a wedding. That's usually just something that people just do anyway. They'll just, even if it's just some sandwiches. No, not this one. I got nothing. And asked if I could, like, buy some crisps from behind the bar. They said the bar was shut, so I couldn't do that, couldn't eat. And then the woman said, oh, go and get the Toastmaster, sort something out for you. He come out with a plate full of leftovers from the main course that people hadn't eaten.
No.
already not his number one fan. So then I go into the hall at about 6:15, right? So I thought, give myself 15 minutes to set up, ready for when the cake and stuff is done. So I go into the hall. There's people gathered around the dance floor, right? So I've gone running over. I'm thinking, what's going on here? Maybe there's a fight or something. I've gone running over. I wish there was. That would have been amazing. go running over, and they just finish cutting the cake and start winning the cake off, and then just dive straight into the first dance.
Oh no!
So I've missed the cake,
and you missed, like, you're just getting the tail on the first dance.
Yeah. Oh,
God.
So I thought, well, I'm not going to mention it today. That would have spoiled their day. But then I dropped the bride an email a couple of days later and just said, look, you know, this was the situation. You had a Toastmaster told me this time. I then did it earlier. So I missed that bit. But, I mean, fortunately, you know, she was disappointed that I didn't get the cake. But I said, look, if anyone else, I'm assuming that you have other people there filming it, if you can get the footage, send it over to me. I'll, you know, edit that in. But she never did. But that was, I think that was the final straw for me, where I was like, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah. No, this is the thing. With regards to that, like, food side of things, like, I've been a guest at a few weddings, and I've been sometimes privy to see the sort of behind the scenes things on that sort of a beautiful day. And let's just say, if you're not dealing with like a bride, which is like, who is super stressed because she wants it to be absolutely perfect, you are dealing with every other relative in that situation who wants their little piece of the action, just like my moment to shine. And I got to say, yeah, with regards to food, the way sort of budgets are done for weddings, yeah, if you don't have it put in your contract that you're going to get fed, I would simply say it will be kind of, you're skating on thin ice there. But
it's funny though, because with doing weddings and stuff, you meet like the photographer and stuff on the day, and then you almost like create this little two-person support group for the day. And then even when you're like having your little break and eating stuff, they'll always say, I absolutely hate doing weddings.
Yeah.
All the same, they're like, this is killing me slowly, this is drained. And it's funny. It's funny, but it's that the downside to it is, the upside to it even is that it's lucrative.
Paying
the money for it.
Yeah, because like, this is the thing. I'm not by all means in a photographer or a filmographer, but I would imagine with regards to what you have to do, like, yeah, everyone will have to, I think it's kind of like this bizarre rite of passage you kind of had to do, because it's like, okay, you do the film, you do the weddings, and like, yeah, there are some people that go, yay, weddings, this is my thing. And they stay there and they sort of do other things. But it's like the sort of thing where it's like, okay, I've got X amount of cash, and if I get really desperate, I might come back to this. But this
will
take me through to the next year, like a year and a half. Because like, that's the thing about wedding seasons. Like, it's like, it goes from March to around about December, depending. Mm. And you just can't make that cash.
Yeah, it's constant.
Yeah. Like when you say it's rather lucrative, I'm not going to ask you or like presume how much you got paid for that, but you know what I mean? It's like, I would imagine
it would. Yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, it definitely wasn't in the realms that a lot of other people were charging, but it's, for me, it was what I felt, you know, it was worth, and it was good money for the amount of work that was being done. But that was always kind of, you know, a stopgap until I started doing more corporate stuff. And it's funny how when you sort of get into it, you kind of see that as a leg up when it's two completely different things. And anyone that's looking for someone to do corporate stuff is not interested in watching a wedding that you've done. so afterwards you find that you have to keep them two things completely separate, because no one's going to hire you based off of a wedding video that you did to then make a, you know, a promo for their business. It was weird. So I had to do a few freebies of that in the end to then get into that. But then that was another one where, you know, I was happier because I had more control over the shoots and stuff. And then I could always stop people and go, look, that was good. Let's try this. Blah, blah, blah. But then after a while, you kind of, I don't know, you, from like a creative standpoint, you you get bored because you're kind of essentially making the same thing over and over again. It's just, yeah, with the interview bit and then a bit of like some cutaway shots and then that's it. It's just like, there's only so many like little short films you can make about someone's marketing business.
Yeah. I'd imagine if
it's draining.
Yeah. I imagine if you're going from a sort of editing standpoint, it most probably comes to a point where you just do it in your sleep and all you're just doing is changing the little labels for their names.
But it's funny because you get involved and they're always kind of like, oh, you know, we want to do something that's going to go viral, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then they'll give you like an example. And you're like, okay, yeah, right. If you want to do something that's going to vote, you're going to have to do something that, you know, different and that's a bit out there, which is what, yeah, this example is. And they're like, oh, no, we just want to do something safe. okay, so you don't want a viral video then. It's like you just want to play it. You just want to play it safe and, yeah, just do something quite dull and boring. So then you end up just, you get involved thinking, oh, I'm going to make something really, you know, cool and fun.
Yeah.
But then you just end up with the same thing that you always make again and again. So it's almost like you're just working from the same template for every video. And yeah, after a while, it kind of drains your creativity. After a while, you're like, just doing the same thing over and over again.
So like basically you've been hammering tonging it all the way through, like weddings, corporate gigs, and like pretty much the same. Let's say the same bag, like just with a slightly different label. So how did you sort of discover the sort of whole realm of a VR?
Ah, well, funnily enough, so it was, I don't know what's going on with my camera here, but it's going you would never think that I was, I was in this industry with this camera, with this dodgy camera setup.
I'm just looking at you right now, like, going, so you work in film, huh?
he's an amateur.
Oh yeah. Think twice about hiring people.
I'm the poster boy for not being hired. this is not the best show reel.
I'm not saying a word.
Go to the website instead. Yes,
something else filmable.
The VR stuff. So yeah, it was I was kind of introduced to the 360 video side of it at first, just on a phone. And I was showing a video of, I think it was an Ed Sheeran concert at Wembley Stadium.
Uh-huh.
And I remember just holding the phone and just moving it around and just seeing it, you know, just be able to see all around me, just on the screen. And that kind of blew my mind. And at first I kind of put it down to witchcraft as opposed to technology, because I just didn't think that sort of thing was possible. But then weirdly enough, it was my dad that kind of introduced me to watching something on a headset. He'd bought like this cheap headset just to try out one of the old ones that you put your phone in.
Oh yeah.
He brought it over one day and he said, oh, you need to have a look at this. This is pretty cool. And yeah, that was the moment that I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing. Not only, you know, it's one thing to make stuff that people can just watch on the screen and have this like connection with, but it's something completely different to then just plonk them in the middle of that story and kind of make them a part of it. So with that, I thought, right, I need to get myself a 360 camera so I can play around with this a bit more. Mm-hmm. And at the time they were very much in their infancy and Samsung had the main one that was just, the Samsung Gear 360, it was called.
Right.
And it was like a 4K camera, but that 4K is stretched in like a spherical video. Mm. So it's not the 4K that we would know watching on a TV or on YouTube and stuff. But it only worked with Samsung phones. And I had an iPhone at the time. So I was like, right, okay, well, this is getting traded in. So I traded that in for a Samsung Galaxy just purely so I could get this camera.
Yeah.
And test it out. And then I reached out to the London Lion basketball team in Stratford. Mm-hmm. And said, hey, I'd like to come down to one of your matches, wherever one, don't mind, and just film some stuff, just, you know, for my own showreel. And then you guys can have it and use it, you know, for any promotional stuff or anything you want. And they were like, yep, yeah, fine, no worries. We'll choose a game and we'll sort you out a press pass. So it's like, cool. So that was awesome, because that was one of the things I quite liked about shooting VI, is that you just kind of hit record and you just let it do its thing. You don't have to worry. Once you've kind of seen it on the phone, what the angle looks like and stuff like that, you can just go and just chill for a bit. Yeah. So that's essentially what I did for the game. I just let it go, and then I'd just sit down and watch the game. And then each quarter I would just change the angle a bit. So essentially I just got a free game out of it, which is great.
Nice.
And then, yeah, from there I started just shooting other like little bits and pieces, and then selling like 360 stock footage as well, because no one was really doing that at the time. And then that's kind of when I was like in between living arrangements. So I decided to buy a one-way ticket to Chiang Mai in Thailand. Yeah, it went a bit weird. I was kind of having like a crisis of whether I wanted to carry on doing corporate gigs and stuff.
Right.
And it was still early days in the whole VR thing. So nobody was really, you know, hiring as such, because no one was really wanted to take a punt on that kind of technology, because they didn't know if it was going to be a worthwhile investment.
Mm.
So I thought, I'll have a bit of downtime. I'll move out to Southeast Asia for a bit. Yeah.
Like, you know what? I'm never going to go to that basketball, like, to watch them play basketball. Because, like, for it to sort of kick off an existential crack, you know what? I need to go to Indonesia. What happened to that guy? He's gone to Indonesia.
He's gone. He's gone to find himself. So it was more like a, you know, what I wanted to do sort of going forward, and more careerized. But yeah, then I got like a cheap flight out there. And by cheap, like, I mean a flight that goes all around the houses. So it was about the journey itself, in terms of flights and like holdovers and stuff, was like 30 hours. So by the time I got there, I was practically a corpse. And slept.
Oh my God.
The worst thing about it, and this is something I thought was a really good idea, and I thought I was being safe, and I wouldn't advise this to anyone, but I thought, because I got free flights, so I flew from Stansted to Cologne in Germany.
Okay.
Then 12-hour flight from Cologne to Bangkok, and then it's about an hour flight from Bangkok to Chiang Mai. Now, I thought, because it was different airlines, obviously I'd have to then get my case and then recheck in, right? Because I was doing it cheap. So I thought, just to play it safe, just in case there's any delays, I will get the flights that have the 6-hour layovers in between flights, right? And naturally, there were no delays. So each stopover, I had a full 6 hours to just sit in an airport and ponder what I'd done.
I have this feeling you might be a sadist to yourself.
Yeah. I got that feeling when I was on the 12-hour flight to Bangkok, and then realized I had booked a ticket that didn't include food or entertainment.
What? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't read the small print.
Oh my God. It's like, yeah, you know what? I'm on this plane for the next 12 hours. At least they'll give me some food.
Yep. No.
What? No. It's like, No, you didn't.
And then when they were finally coming down with the trolley, they were in the row in front of me, and I thought, brilliant, I'm starving. I can't wait to get something to eat here. Then there was a bit of turbulence. They went back. They didn't come back again. So, yeah, I had to go the whole 12 hours without having anything to eat and literally no entertainment other than what happened to be on my phone. So, yeah, so it was, okay. Didn't think any of that through.
Okay.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, that is a torturous journey. Well, at least you give yourself 6 hours breaks in between each section to just like let yourself
recover. And also, I just would, it probably be worth pointing out that I'd also didn't realize that I was heading out to Thailand during raining season. So I thought, I'll have a nice break, get some nice weather. Nope. I get a lot of rain, but it was warm rain. So that was still a bit different.
Well, at least you didn't feel like you missed the UK.
Yeah, exactly. but strangely, as soon as I got there, there was a VR platform in Beijing that reached out to me. About like doing some stuff with them. And so part of that was just like editing promotional content for them. And that was really handy because that instantly just paid all my bills while I was out there. And my bills were low, so I didn't need to bring in so much. So just doing that job on its own, which was only took like a few hours a week, that paid for my living costs. And so I'd recommend it if anyone's having an existential crisis, go out to Chiang Mai.
Minus the 30 hours.
Yeah. go a quicker route if you can. But it's worth it when you get there because you can get an apartment for about 170 a month.
Nice.
Including bills and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good. Well, so it's not bad little life. Yeah.
And when you say 170 a month, is that a decent quality apartment or is that like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's essentially like a kind of like a hotel room. And yeah, the place that the complex I stayed in had a pool, which was nice. And I had a balcony that overlooked the pool, which is good. I can't really speak for the clientele around the pool sometimes. There was one guy in particular who would just be out there in his budgie smugglers.
Oh God.
Getting a suntan. Yeah. It was practically a thong. And he'd be laying face down. You're like, you know what? I'm going to have my coffee inside.
It's like,
it's fine. Yeah. So, don't worry, man. You do you. I'm going to go back in. It's
like every freaking morning. Yeah. Come out, yeah. Look out.
When are they going to kick him out?
It's like, never.
So I was working for this company, and then they then started asking me to create some VR content for them as well. And they started this new feature on their platform that was like an interactive VR storage. So then you could like go and, you know, watch this thing, and then it gets to a certain point in a story, and then you can choose where the story goes next.
Yeah.
So they asked if I wanted to make something to help promote that. So I created this little like horror experience that was set in the complex, and then just roped like in friends that I'd made while I was out there to help me with it. And and then it kind of went from there. And then after I was there for a few months, I moved to Penang in Malaysia, partly because my visa was running up, so I needed to go somewhere else. So I went out there and started just going around and just shooting bits and pieces in 360 to sell online, and still doing the editing for this company Veer, they were called. Mm-hmm. And then I randomly got an email asking if I'd be interested in going out to Indonesia to direct like a series of commercials for their board of tourism. And naturally, like, this isn't real. This is the dream job. So there's no way this could be real. Yeah. And so then I just, you know, there was a bit of an email back and forth. And then I was like, oh, actually, maybe this is real. And I got that email, I think on a Wednesday. They asked me to send over like a showreel to sort of pitch to the tourism agency.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, for them to okay me getting the job. So I basically just quickly cobbled together a load of stuff that I'd shot while I was in Thailand. And then on the Thursday, they're like, yep, you've got the job. We'll like book your flight for Saturday. So 2 days later, I was like, right, okay, well, I'm leaving Malaysia. I'm heading out to Indonesia now. So it was a very, very quick turnaround. And it was strange because that was my first job as like solely as a director.
Yeah.
Whereas everything else I'd worked on before, I was, you know, just shooting myself and, you know, jack of all trades. Like, you know, master of none.
Yeah, you're a jack of all trades.
I was doing everything. I was operating the camera, I was editing, I was, you know, wrote the theme tune, sung the theme tune, you know, all of it. And this was the first thing I'd done where I was literally just there to delegate to other people. And I'd never done that before, let alone to people that never spoke the language. But the thing is, I didn't know that until I got there. I was under the impression that it was going to be me and one other guy going to all of these different locations and shooting stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think I was just naive, and I was just excited about the prospect of being able to travel around the country and someone else pay for it. So I turned up at Jakarta Airport.
Yeah.
And I get a text from the guy who I was told was my assistant, who was actually one of the producers as well. And he was like, oh, you know, someone's coming to collect you from the airport. They'll meet you at this place. So I was like, okay, brilliant. So I get there. There's a guy there. Didn't speak any English. All I sort of made out was that, oh, we're meeting the driver at this car park. And I'm thinking, why have we got a driver? Why are you not driving? So anyway, we get to this car park, and this like van with blacked out windows pulls up. And that was the point I thought, I think I should have done my homework here. Like, am I being kidnapped?
bath, so ice.
And then I spent like, it was about a 40-minute journey to the hotel where I was staying, and it was the longest 40 minutes of my life, because I'm just sitting in the back thing, because they were asking to take photos of my passport, asking for my plane ticket stub. And I thought, why do they need that? They obviously want to hide any evidence that I was on that flight. And I'm thinking, hang on, that's gonna be in a system somewhere anyway. But I'm just sitting in the back of this van thinking, I don't know what's happening here. Is this a real thing, or am I being sex trafficked? I don't know. Like, I really wish Liam Neeson was my dad at this point.
Oh, just like, I'm now picturing you just like scantily clad, like,
yeah.
Like to a group of sailors. Do you want a good time?
Yeah. Wearing a little mini skirt
going down your like cheek, going. I used to make films, you know. Yeah,
I know all the angles.
Literally,
yeah, yeah. But I digress. But yeah, I spent like most of that journey just like texting people saying, look, if you haven't heard from me in 2 hours time, like, get onto the embassy or something. Excuse me.
Call the police.
Yeah. But then we got there and it turned off down this like dark street and I thought, this is it. This is game over. But then I saw a sign for the hotel that I was staying at and I thought, oh, okay, we are actually going to the hotel. But then even when I got to the hotel, I still didn't feel safe. As I was going up to the room, I thought, maybe they're just lulling me into this false sense of security and there's someone waiting in the room when I get in there with some chloroform or something.
No, just walk into the room, everything just covered in plastic.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's like, oh, damn it. But then, you know, fortunately, I got in there. It was all fine. There was no one waiting for me. And then I had a meeting. So this was on the Saturday. I had the meeting at the production company's office on the Sunday evening to talk about stuff. And that was like the first time I'd met everyone. And then actually had a better idea of the project itself. And then that's when I thought, oh, there's going to be three of us, because I was introduced to another guy who was like a drone operator. So I thought, okay, there's three of us.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting there having a chat and stuff like that. And then they give me the itinerary. And this is like, I don't know, 7 or 8 o'clock on the Sunday evening. And they were like, right, here's the itinerary. Looking at it, it's like, oh, we fly out at 3 o'clock in the morning. So the first thing. So I'm like, okay, there's no messing about here. I'm literally going to just get about 3 hours sleep tonight. And that's it. And then that was for like a solid, I think the shoot lasted about 22, 23 days maybe. Okay. And that was every day, like all day, every day. And yeah, so I arrived at the airport. I had to go on my own, jump in a cab to the airport. And then all these other people started turning up. And that's when I realized that it was actually a full crew of people. And I don't want to use the term actors. Basically, they hired like Instagram influencers to be in the video. And that is, yeah, that's something to behold, an Instagram influencer. They're brilliant to watch.
What does that mean?
Just any opportunity for a photo. It's incredible. It's absolutely just mesmerizing to watch. But then as it went on, I felt obligated then to just try and like bomb every single photo that they tried to take. Yeah. So there's like, and or try and reenact anything they did. So if there was like one where they'd like one of the guys sitting on a rock and just pulls their top down to one side to have a bit of shoulder on show, I'd be like, right, well, I'll do that. I can do that. Now I'm going to go one better. I'm going to have both shoulders out. So that was my own little game that I played throughout the shoot to try and keep myself entertained as well. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. So anyway, yeah. So in the end, there was about 10 or 11 of us.
Mm.
And I was essentially the captain of this ship. And it was, yeah, the biggest undertaking I'd ever took on. And I was unaware of it. And then, so this first plane journey to the first location, I pretty much spent the whole time thinking, oh shit, what have I done here? Like, am I going to be able to pull this off?
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you just have this massive anxiety because you're like, this is bigger than anything I've ever done. The client itself is huge. They've got a massive following online. Yeah. And you kind of really start to doubt your ability to do the job. But then once we got to the first location, which was whitewater rafting, so we jumped in straight away. We did all, because so basically the project was like a series of VR commercials to promote parts of Indonesia that didn't have any tourism at that point. So we was going to all these different locations and doing things that would be considered like touristy. So whitewater rafting, going to like other little villages and stuff where they make like dresses and things like that. And it was amazing. And I think that project was probably the one time, you know, considering that I did that journey there, just terrified, thinking I'm going to mess this up. I'm not qualified for this. I've never done something on this scale before. But after that first day, like I'm not going to lie, I actually felt like I belonged there. It's kind of like, this is what I'm meant to be doing. Like that's directing is more my thing. Mm. Because I think when you're kind of a one man band and you're kind of focusing on all these different things, and you know, for me, I'm focusing on the technical things because I don't want anything to get messed up. And that takes me away from what I'm trying to do with that video and the story that I'm trying to get across and things like that. Whereas this, on this project, I had other people setting up the camera and stuff for me, so I could concentrate on what I wanted the actors or the talent, as we refer to them, as what I wanted them to do and how the viewer would see that in the headset. Because it's the thing with VR is very different to traditional filmmaking, because you can't point the viewer in the direction that you want them to look. So you have to be quite clever about it. So they're essentially going to look wherever they want. So you've got to be clever about it and, you know, do it in a way where something's going on that's going to grab their attention. And then they're just automatically, you know, it's human nature that they're just going to follow that. So I don't know, that it was weird because I was just panicking the whole time. And then when I got there and started getting into it, it just felt very, very natural. So we did that for about 23 days and while I was still doing the editing and the freelance editing work and stuff in the evening. So we would be up and out of the hotel about 5 o'clock in the morning, get back, have something to eat. I'd probably finish, get back to my room about 9 o'clock at night, then edit to about 1 o'clock in the morning and then do it all again the following day. So I was exhausted. But it's the most rewarding thing I've ever worked on, like easily. I love traveling, I love exploring different cultures and things like that. And to do that in a place that isn't touristy, and doing it with locals as well, so you get to see what like the proper country and what it's actually about. And experience it as a local, just, you know, just changes things completely. And, you know, we went to a lot of farm places. We went into this jungle to film orangutans, which was just incredible. Just watching this orangutan with her baby just come like walking up to the camera and just like look at it and walk around it and stuff like that, while we were all hiding behind a tree, because obviously it's 360, so everyone's in shot, so you just have to hit record and then go and hide. But we also wanted to watch. So you'd have to all like hide behind this tree, but also trying to sort of peek out and watch this orangutan and see what it's up to. And then we filmed in a bat cave, which was a crazy experience on its own. All these different places. And then we ended up in the Gili Islands, which is massively touristy. And I hated it. Absolutely hated it. As soon as we landed on the beach, I was like, do we have to come in? I know we're only here for a couple of days, but I'm already over this. There's too many Westerners here. I don't like it. And it's funny because you see the difference that it has. Because it was mostly Australians there, but on our last day, we went out for dinner and then went out for drinks. It's like our rap party, and it's like all these Australian kids just fighting in the bar over nothing. And you're like, why? What's the, like, everyone's here just, you know, for a fun time. Why are you coming in and ruining it? You know, everywhere else has been so relaxed and so chilled, and, you know, never felt, you know, any animosity between anyone and stuff like that in any place that I've been in, like, the last 3 weeks. And then I come here where there's, like, other Westerners, and straight away it's kicking off.
Well,
and I know.
Children strange vinegar, and, like, they're off to go.
Exactly. So then we shot all that, and then we flew back to Jakarta, and they very kindly put me up in the hotel again for another few days to let me have a bit of time to just kind of take a breath and actually go and check out Jakarta as well, which is really nice. But I got back to the hotel, and I think that was, like, the first time I'd actually got to kind of take a step back and kind of realize what had actually gone on in the last 3 weeks and the experiences that I had, and, you know, just being able to, you know, just for, you know, people to trust me with, like, a project of that magnitude that I wasn't used to. And I broke down in, like, the hotel room. It just kind of overwhelmed me, and because of the time difference, I didn't have anyone to call up to just kind of unload on. So I just, like, sat on the edge of the bed, just like,
I'm so grateful.
And then they paid for me to get a flight home as well, which is awesome, and a quick way, which is lovely.
It's like, how did you fly here? You went, he did the devil's run. Yes, the devil's run.
It was literally planes, trains, and automobiles on the way here. So then I got home, and they were like, right, we're gonna edit it all up. So I sent over, like, some editing notes, and how, you know, each shot was going to play into the next. And then they were editing it, and then it was all due. This was at the end of November, and it was due to be released on Christmas Eve. And it was going to be this big thing. There was going to be a main edit that was going to go out on YouTube. And then all the others were going to be used in, like, travel conferences and stuff to be shown on headsets around that. And then I think it was about 2 or 3 days before it was due to be released, there was a tsunami in Indonesia that killed about 200 people. So they shelved it. And now I think it's just been completely shelved now, because it hasn't been released since. So it would have been, you know, a great thing to have on the CV, and it still is to a degree, but it would be nice to have for people to actually be able to see to have seen it. Yeah. Because even though I haven't seen the edit and stuff, it's a project that I'm, like, really proud of. Because I know how it would look. Every shot was meticulously planned. And it would have been, it would have been really cool little film. But, yeah, unfortunately never saw the light of day. And I thought that was going to be my ticket to, like, other bigger and better projects. Yeah. And then it didn't quite happen.
Hey, like, this is the thing. Like, going from a basketball game in London and then basically taking, like, doing the Kessel Run to get to Malaysia, up in Indonesia, then, like, getting into a van where you, like, fucking out. Oh, good God. It's like, but, like, I would say, for me, the way you, like, telling the story, it felt like you had the opportunity to sort of take a step back twice. Like, one, like, when you got into the initial project itself, and, like, going, okay, I've got this crew of people and stuff like this, where I've got, I thought it was going to be 3 of us, but it's, like, I've got all this, quote-unquote, talent from Instagram and, like, doing it all, and, like, going, right, I'm not dealing with the camera, I'm now directing. That's to go, and for you to go, okay, I can take that sort of natural breath and, like, get into the fray of the chaos of it all, which I think maybe the weddings and the corporate gigs may have helped with that, where you may, like, if you didn't do that, you may have.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you got to the end of it all, it was like, okay. Yeah. You could, like, you had your first moments as, I would say, really sort of like exhale. It's like, and go, okay, right. And like, this is the thing. I think in some respects, I think this is the reason why people need to do these like crazy wedding corporate gigs at the beginning, just to know if you've got what it takes to stick at it. Look, granted, I'm not going to tell people to take a 30-hour flight around the world.
Neither would I.
Like, you were true. Whoops. You were truly living a digital nomad life for a period of time. Like, and all you had, like, were you doing this editing on a super powerful computer or was it?
No.
Yeah.
The laptop I had at the time was the bane of my life.
Oh, God.
It was so slow.
What was it?
So slow. I can't remember now. It's like some Lenovo laptop. But like spec-wise, there was enough in there that was capable of doing the job on paper, but it just didn't want to know. So it was a struggle, and that's why the you know, during that shoot, the edits of an evening took so long, and then I was coasting on about 4 hours sleep. So it was a struggle. So that was the first thing to go when I got back. It's like, I'm not dealing with you anymore.
like, this is the thing. When you hear the old adage, gear doesn't matter. I simply go, you're right. It doesn't matter in some respects of if you're telling a story, you can really tell a good story. Film I watched just the other day for my other podcast, Sherlock Jr. Basically, oh, God. Why am I blanking on the guy's name? Basically, it's a 1924 film. It was, bear with me 1 second. Charlotte Jr., yes. Buster Keaton, like starring Buster Keaton. And all I've got to say is, like, it's 96 years old, and like that film had me laughing out loud at moments. The way the sort of filming was done, it would hold up extremely strongly with films today. And like, when you're talking 100 years ago, I have no idea what lens they were using or what sort of or whatnot. But I wouldn't say, like, your camera phone would most really kick the ass of everything they had back then. But it tells a coherent story. It's a silent film. So basically the script is most probably a page and a half, 2 pages max. And it's just like, wow, amazing. But that's with the gear they had then. And like, when you're going, I had my Lenovo laptop and it took me ages to do. And like, this is the thing, gear doesn't matter, but it does matter when it comes to the ends of the workflow, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially laptop-wise, you need something that's, going to do the job and not drive you insane. I think, camera-wise, you can get away with it now. As long as the audio is good, you can get away with, to a degree, shooting something on a potato. If the audio's all right, it's fine. But with the VR thing though, it's a bit different because the higher the image quality, the better it's going to look on a headset, because it's all well and good saying, this is a 8K camera and stuff, but you kind of always have to remember that that's 8K around. So that 8K is stretched out into a sphere. So it's not going to look as good. That makes it slightly more difficult to own these things because, the higher up cameras are 12K and whatnot, they're like $4,000 or $5,000. So I don't bother keeping any of them for shoots. But I'll like rent them, if I'm booked for something. But yeah, once I got back from Indonesia, I thought that's going to be it. Going to just focus on directing VR from now on. And then I started working with a mental health charity, producing some like workplace training exercises.
Okay.
Which is really, really cool to work on. And that was basically just different, scenes that would play out potentially in the workplace. And then the managers in these workplaces could then book a training session. They'd put on the headset and then, kind of live through these little scenes where, someone in the workplace was coming to them, saying that they had, problems and stuff, and how they could, what's the best way to approach that. So we did some of that, and then still waiting. We were waiting to hear back, about funding like a full lineup of them. But then COVID hit. And when your distribution tactic relies on people sharing something that they wear on their head during a pandemic, doesn't really help.
I can understand how that might be frowned upon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of thrown the industry into a bit of disarray at the moment, because, that's always been the downside to it. There isn't really any distribution avenue for it. Now even less so, because people can't share headsets and stuff at the moment, and who knows when that's going to end. I mean, even once the pandemic kind of dies down a bit, people are still going to be reluctant to to share a headset with other people. It's been a difficult year, 2 years maybe.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think it's going to be maybe some hard road ahead for the next sort of 12 to 18 months. I'm not going to lie about that. But one of the things I would say, which it most probably be encouraging about the sort of sector you're in with the sort of VR like headset, the Oculus Rift, they are making constant improvements on that. And I can't remember other brands, but it's gone from being cabled up to a desktop PC or a laptop.
Yep.
Now it's just a headset itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the prices are coming down on that on a sort of regular basis. So yeah. I think in a year's time, 2 years, the sort of market might be a hell of a lot different, and the content, like there's going to be a major sort of upswing for need of content, because look,
I mean, they've seen like a, sorry to interrupt, they've seen like an uptick in sales of the Oculus Quest and stuff since COVID hit, which has been great. But like you say, there isn't as much content at the moment, and it's a difficult one. It's, some people are going to be reluctant to spend like £400 on a headset because there isn't that much content, but people aren't making the content because there isn't as many people with a headset. And it's kind of,
Meg.
So, it's a difficult one, but I still like making stuff of VR. I think there's still a future for it. I also like that it's still in its infancy, and there's like no one knows the rules of it yet.
Yeah.
You can still create this VR filmmaking language. And it's like the early days of cinema. I don't know if you're aware, like the first film that was ever screened in a cinema, and it was just a train like heading towards the camera. And basically everyone that was in that cinema was terrified because they thought the train was going to hit them because they'd never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
And it's a similar thing with VR, because it has this way of, when you've got the headset on, at least it has this way of tricking your brain into thinking that you're actually there, even though you know full well deep down that you're just sitting in your living room. Your brain's like, no, you're here, and this thing's gonna attack you in a minute if you don't if you don't get a shift on. So and it's kind of cool to be at the beginning of that kind of thing, kind of help write, you know, the rules around how the content would work and stuff.
Yeah,
but you know, you've also got to be careful that some people get a bit nauseous in a headset, so you've got to be careful of that as well. So there's all these things to take into account.
I'll tell you this. Like, I was this must have been about 4 or 5 years ago. I was in a new game store. It was like a huge flagship store where they had all these compute, like had a gaming area, had everything. So it's like encourages you to stay there. And like, I managed to get in on opening day. And I was like, yeah, nice. I had a VR headset. I don't know what racing game I was playing. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, driving along, going speed. And like, I did a slide turn, drifted around. And then like, all I could like film was my leg, like, I was like, okay. I had to put my hand down to stop me falling. I went from high speed to like, we're going to just go along real nice, real slow. Because, it was trippy. Got to.
It is.
Yeah, if I was playing a shooting up or a fighting game, I would hit someone, I'm sure.
Like, stay away. Definitely. But I feel like that's probably like the next step up in terms of storytelling. Like, I'm a big fan of like horror movies and stuff. I've always loved them ever since I was a kid. Yeah. But I'm not, they don't scare me. Because after a while, you know the beats, you know when that jump, you know, bit's gonna come. But in VR, I'm terrified because I don't know what's coming. And because I also think I'm in the room with this, you know, malevolent force or whatever. And I feel like, you know, in terms of being a horror fan and stuff, that's kind of the next step up in terms of, you know, horror movies and stuff, putting the viewer in one. So it's cool to be on the, early doors stages of writing the language of VR filmmaking on that front.
Do you think, like, because like you mentioned just now, like, yeah, you like horror is your thing, but do you think there will actually be a full-on sort of feature film, like a whole
VR?
Yeah, in VR.
Because
Why is that?
Maybe once the headsets have got a lot smaller, like to the point of just being just like normal, regular glasses. I think wearing that headset on your head for like an hour and a half is going to be too much.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the moment, the maximum you're probably going to get is about half an hour.
Okay.
Tops. After that, yeah, the headset kind of gets on your nerves after a while. I mean, for the Chinese VR platform that I did some work for, after I got back, I was still doing some bits for them. But they started doing online events in VR, where they'd bring in filmmakers who have just released something on their platform to talk about their work. And so I would host it and just sort of kind of compare, and if you can believe that, in VR. And so I'd have to like have a headset on for about, yeah, probably about an hour and a half, because I'd have to get there early. It's not a real place. All I had to do is just put a headset on. That's the most amount of traveling I did for that. But then like meet with the guests and sort of take them through everything, and then spend about an hour or so like chatting and stuff like that. But after that, like, you know, your head, especially around your eyes and stuff, you just feel sweaty and horrible and stuff. So yeah, but people were saying no longer if it's a gaming thing, because you're more immersed in the gaming because you have to think and react and stuff like that.
Mm.
But if you're watching a film in VR, I think 30 minutes at this point in time is probably going to be the maximum amount you're going to get away with. But maybe in the future, once headsets are, you know, smaller and lighter, then yeah, it's definitely potential there.
My mind. So
watch your space.
Yeah, I would imagine. Wow, advancements. 10 to 12 years, maybe. Okay.
You heard it here first, people.
Yes. This is the thing. Like, I've got to say, like, digital nomad, like, stock footage, like, taker, like, and like, yeah, all around. I'm gonna have to definitely put sadist on there because,
yeah, by all means. I might as well. I'm already a pretty much a multi hyphenate, so let's just might as well throw that in as well.
Yeah. So, like, this is the thing. Like, I know you've done some short films. Like, is it a case, like, hey, look, look, you've put this stuff out in the world.
That's true. Yeah, I did. I did do that.
Yep. Like, from the short films, do you think it's a case of you're going to do more short films? Or are you going to, like, yeah, do something, looking to do something more grander?
Maybe a bit of both. I think that's kind of the path I'm kind of heading down at the moment, trying to sort of do more of my own stuff and the stuff that I'm more passionate about. Mm-hmm. So the shorts are definitely on there. There's a VR series that I'm working on. Funnily enough, that's horror based. But I miss like working on stuff and, you know, putting everything into it and then just putting it out there and then letting other people, you know, have it. It's like after that it's theirs then. Whereas you don't really have that with the more corporate stuff because it's not really your edit usually. It's usually their version of the thing, not yours.
So taking, I would imagine.
Yeah. So I don't tend to have a lot of it like on my site because it's not my version of it. So I don't really feel like I can promote it as that. And also I found that you tend to get more work through the stuff that you've done on your own and not for someone else because it's, you know, people can see that, you know, you've put your heart into it. I went on a bit of a tangent there, but yeah, there's some shorts in the works, but yeah, I definitely love to do, you know, like most people would love to do a feature, at some point. And, you know, like we were saying before with the cameras and stuff, it's, you know, it's easy to do that now. I mean, the only downside is that, you know, everyone for the most part is kind of doing it now. So it's harder to cut through the noise, which is a bit annoying.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, if I can, you know, in the future, just when I'm on my deathbed, just, you know, think to myself, you know what, I did make a feature like once in my life, you know, and five people saw it, three of them liked it, but I'd be happy with that. I mean check with me on my deathbed. see if I'm still happy about that.
See me show up on that particular day just like, yeah, hey Dan, oh no.
Yeah,
I want to live. I've got more time.
Yeah. It's funny though because I don't like when you get feedback from clients and stuff that you've done, it's I don't know, you kind of struggle not to take it personally when they want changes and stuff. I've found sometimes anyway, and I know other people that have felt the same, but if it's something that I've done myself and I've put it out there and people hate it, or it's got some hate online, I don't really care. I don't care because I'm like, you know what? I liked it, so yeah. That's fine. That's down to you. It's really weird. So yeah, I kind of miss having the freedom to do that in a way. I had weirdly, I did. I think it's the first short I ever done, and it's not online anymore because I don't know. I'm like my own biggest critic. I tend to like hate a lot of stuff I do. But I put it out. It was online for a little bit, and then I thought, oh, I can't leave that out there. I'm taking that down. And I can't remember how I come across it, but a couple of years ago, I found that someone had pirated it, and it was available for download on a pirate website, which is really bizarre. There's like, there's no need. There was absolutely no market for anyone to want to watch this. But weirdly enough, I actually got good reviews on this pirate website. Very strangely enough.
Well, you know, maybe that's the universe telling you something. Because
maybe. No, but that was shot on camcorders years ago. So now I'm also like, do I want to put that out? Because the camera quality is not that good because it's old. But then at the same time, the audio is good. So,
but that's the thing. I would simply say this. Like when you, like back in the day when you had the old Cafe Ray TVs, right? When you had you could watch something, even if it was a fuzzy screen, as long as the like actual sound was perfectly fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And like the only thing with today's technology with digital, when it comes through and it's all bitty, the sound's like all over the place. So you can't watch
it.
So I would say with a camcorder, if the sound is like great, I think many a person might actually watch it.
Maybe I'll do a limited release of it again.
Yes. Yeah.
Who knows? But yeah, no, there's definitely, more in the works that I'd like to do. That's something for the future. But obviously also I need to pay bills.
Yes, indeed.
That's the problem. So hopefully one day we'll get to a point where there'll be the stuff that pay the bills.
So if one quick question before we
go for it,
start wrapping up, like if there was a film you could remake throughout time in history, which film would you do?
That's a really good question. And a very difficult one because I hate remakes. For the most part, they're terrible. This is good. Might be too good. I don't know. It'd have to be like maybe something old, like 80s, but maybe not something that's so beloved. Do you know what? I know what I might do. So there's I can't really talk about it too much because there's spoilers and stuff. And if anyone decides to watch this, I would stay away from reading anything about it online. But there's this old 80s horror movie called Sleepaway Camp. It's not one of like the wider known ones, but it's one of those like standard run of the mill 80s slasher films. And I'm not going to lie, about 89 minutes of that film is just, pretty rubbish. There's a few funny bits in there, but the ending just completely floored me the first time I watched it. And it would be interesting to maybe redo that, but actually have the whole film be good as opposed to just that final. And also the acting in it is absolutely atrocious, but it's worth it just for the final scene. It's just, it's jaw dropping. So maybe I'd remake Sleepaway Camp and I'd get the original star back to do like a little cameo as well. Sleepaway Camp VR.
Possibly. Ooh.
No, probably not. Maybe. Or like a little thing. Yeah. Who knows? But I'd probably go with that, I think.
Like, this is my final question. And
go.
Going to like go with a fun bat. Okay. If there's a film you could watch where the entire cast, apart from one actor, was replaced by Muppets, which film would that be?
Oh, I love this question. I mean, to be honest, any film with that sounds amazing. Do you know what? I think it's probably going to have to be something like action. That's something that's going to be like really ridiculous. Maybe Die Hard.
Die Hard.
That'd be brilliant. Just John McClane, just Bruce Willis himself, but Hans is a Muppet.
as he falls down.
Yeah. But just like wavy arms as he falls.
Or Kermit the Frog as Hans Gruber.
That'd be brilliant. That'd be brilliant. Can you imagine that? It's just like all these international terrorists, but they're just Muppets, just in a gunfight with John McClane. That's the movie I want to watch every Christmas.
There you go. There you go.
Love it.
Excellent. Dan, I got to say, it's been a pleasure having you on today.
Mate, it's been a pleasure being here.
Yes, definitely going to have to get you back on. Yeah,
sounds good.
Like maybe talk more about film and different films out there.
I watch enough of them.
I have a sense you may have watched one or two in your lifetime, but still. Oh, Dan, are you still there? You're back.
There we go.
You froze for a moment. I was like, wait a second. Can you tell the lovely people out there how they can actually get hold of you, how they can contact you over the world wide webs?
Absolutely. I'm on all the social medias at Daniel K. Hatton. That's HATTON. And if anyone wants to reach out or has any questions about anything, you can email me at danielkhatton@gmail.com.
Perfect. Okay, yes. What I'll do for everyone out there who is listening, I'll put all of the contact details in the description, in the show notes. So yes, please reach out to Dan. Dan, take things from there. But I'd like to say thank you to Dan for coming on today, superstar. I didn't drop as many film references as I should, but I will now.
I know, I kind of forgot about that as well. So into it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'd like to say thank you to you, my friends, my life warriors. Thank you for watching. I would like to say, please stay safe, stay well, be awesome, be excellent, be fantastic. Be all the positive bees you can be in this world and then some. Have a great day, people. Peace. And we are...